I believe that everyone in life should have a mission. Making people happy is the height of my ambition. When I get them happy, well, they stay in that condition. 'Cause I have a system all my own. I've got a lot of what I got. And what I got's all mine. And I assure you I can cure you when you're feeling blue.
Welcome, everybody. This is Mark Steiner, and this is July the 28th. And on this day in history, you hear that wonderful voice of Ethel Waters. In 1925, she released his four EP regular songs, and that was one of them. Things like Down Home Blues and Go Back Where You Stayed Last Night. The great Ethel Waters, who was born, you know, interesting. She was born in 1896. Just a little quick story about Ethel Waters before we jump into the rest of our day in history, because she's just a fascinating human being. She was born in 1896. She was the victim. Her mother was raped, and she was a child of that rape. She said, "I was never a child. I never was cuddled or liked or understood by my family." And then she was forced into a marriage when she was only 13 years old, left that man, and then went to some talent contest and was just there for an evening, and they asked her to sing, and she sang, and people fell in love with her singing, and she decided she would then follow us up with a career, and she worked everything from vaudeville to the road, and then she got work in film, and she became an incredible singer on her own and became very famous around the country. She became the highest paid Broadway performer in the history of the United States up to that point in the 1920s. She played in a very funny African-American produced film called Rufus Jones for President that featured the then child performer Sammy Davis Jr. And she was just amazing. She was also, besides being a great singer and an actor, nominated for both an Oscar and an Emmy. She was in love with a woman. And they were so out about their romance and that they were called the two Ethels by everybody. She died in 1977 and was just one of the most magnificent people, a huge presence, both physically and spiritually, and her voice and her acting. So we just thought a little bit more about her today, even though this was not her birthday today or the commemoration of her passing, but was instead that song coming out. We thought it would be good for us to talk about that just for a minute. But let's get on with this day in history. So on this day in history, Thomas, in 1540, Cromwell, who is became the leveler of Great Britain and took over and throughout the monarchy, was executed on a charge of treason by Henry VIII. He was actually tortured to death because it took three times with the axe to take off his head. He was finally killed. His head was boiled later that day. King Henry VIII married his fifth wife, Catherine Howard. So morality and ethics were always strong in every culture on the planet Earth, as we can see from this moment in 1540. This is the day in 1794 that Robespierre had lost his head to guillotine, not tried. And after he led this revolution in France that killed thousands of people, there was a reaction against him, even among the revolutionaries. He and his followers were captured, and he was executed without trial today on the 28th. On this day in 1854, there's a boat in our inner harbor called the USS Constellation. It was on this day in 1854 that the Constellation was the last sailable warship ever placed out of the United States Navy on this day in 1854. And this storied carrier, one of its main jobs was sailing the Atlantic and the west coast of Africa to capture illegal slave ships and to bring slaves back to Monrovia and set them free. And that was the duty of this ship that also fought in the Civil War and now sits decommissioned in our inner harbor. On this day in 1866, a young woman named Vinnie Rehm was the youngest female artist to receive a commission. She's the one who did the sculpture of Lincoln that sits in the U.S. Capitol on this day. And on this day in 1868, the 14th Amendment was ratified. That required three-quarters majority, granting citizenship. You know, the three-quarters of people had to ratify this, the states. It granted citizenship to all persons born and naturalized in the United States. The South and many of the Democrats in that period opposed it because it gave equal rights to African Americans in this country. You cannot deny, any state cannot deny to any person's life, liberty, or property without due process of law, or deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of laws. This 14th Amendment had little effect on the South or most of the country, but it was passed and was used, of course, in our century, in the last century, to begin the great, to kind of be the law that helped end legal segregation in America. On this day in 1917, there was something called the Silent March that took place in Harlem. 10,000 African Americans, organized by W.E.B. Du Bois and the NAACP, marched in protest against lynchings in America, marched in protest against the East St. Louis Massacre, the lynchings and murders in Waco, Texas, and Memphis, Tennessee, that drove over 6,000 African Americans from their homes. 40 African Americans were murdered in this process that on these days. Woodrow Wilson promised he would fight for an anti-lynching law. They tried to keep him to his promise on this silent march. Not a word was spoken on this march. Of course, Woodrow Wilson reneged on all that, and his Confederate sympathies came through loud and clear. But on this day, there was a silent march in Harlem, 10,000 people marching down Fifth Avenue from Harlem, New York. And on this day, in 1932, we will end with this so we can get jump into our day in history, into our regular program. On this day in 1932, Herbert Hoover ordered the United States Army to evict the bonus marchers. There were 43,000 people, 17,000 World War I veterans, black and white, and their families and their children, camped out to demand that the bonuses they were promised be given to them early because they had no money and could not survive. The police attacked. The marchers fought back. The government, Hoover, brought in General Douglas MacArthur with his troops, who then even Douglas MacArthur refused to obey where he was supposed to stop at Anacostia River. When across Anacostia River, marchers were killed. Babies were killed in that attack on the camp. And these were World War I veterans demanding the right to work and their bonus checks. This happened when we attacked our own people here in 1932 in Washington, D.C. And that is our day in history. We'll remember some people were born on this day. Beatrix Potter in 1866, one of the great creator Peter Rabbit, one of the great children's authors of all time. Harriet Bridges, one of the great labor leaders in America, with the longshoreman, was born on this day in 1901. We'll leave it at that, and more will come through during our music on this day in history. We'll come right back with our panel.
See me coming, you better run. Well, Abe said, where you want this killing done? God said, on Highway 61.
Coming back with Bob Dylan, Highway 61, because the great Mike Bloomfield, who played guitar on this track, as well as the Paul Butterfield Band, was born on this day in 1945. So remember him. That was a great song, and he is an incredible guitar player, Paul Butterfield. So let's join our panel here. We are joined here by Dr. Kay Whitehead, once again in the studio, Assistant Professor of Communication, Affiliate Assistant Professor of African and African-American Studies at Loyola University of Maryland, author of the book Notes from a Colored Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis. And when I was in Georgia this last week picking up my youngest daughter from her honors camp in Valdosta, I went to the National Park there just to take a walk through Kennesaw National Park. And in the bookstore was what? But Kay's book, Notes from a Colored Girl, sitting there on the shelf. Dr. Rick Vatz is in the studio, Professor of Rhetoric and Communication at Towson University's Department of Instructional Leadership and Professional Development. He wrote the only authentic book of persuasion, and co-authored last Friday a really interesting analysis of this last election in the Baltimore Sun that you all can read, and we'll hit on our website as well. Dr. Anika Simpson joins us. She's an associate professor in the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies here at Morgan State University, and joins us by phone. Anika, welcome. Good to have you back with us as well.
Thanks, Anika, but thank you.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Thank you for correcting me.
May I just say that your day in history, okay, once again ratifies what my old professor, Robert Newman, used to say to me when I was a graduate student at the University of Pittsburgh, and that is, people are no damn good.
That's a way to start this morning.
Well, with that, we're going to cover a lot of topics on today, but let's begin with one right now that I think that over the last weekend the last week with some of the murders that have taken place in this country, but at the hands of the police, I think it's some time to really kind of wrestle with these issues. What happened to Mr. Ganera in Long Island? But let's play this tape. You have the tape ready to roll? And we'll get that. It's not ready to roll? Okay. So, well, I guess that's not ready, but let's jump into it anyway. So, folks, join me here at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. Email me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888 is the number here to join us for this conversation. We'd love to hear your thoughts. And we're going to cover this. We're going to look at the issues of Ray Rice. We're going to look at what's going on our borders and how that is being affected in the state of Maryland with children coming across the border, even though that's lessened. Look at some of the foreign policy issues if we have time during the course of the hour. Your thoughts on all that, 410-319-8888 is the number here to join us, 410-319-8888. Well, we don't have the tape ready to roll, but we do. Let's play it right now.
Put your hand behind your back.
Once again, police beating up on people.
Back up, then get on that step.
That was a tape, of course, of Mr. Garner dying in the hands of the police on Long Island, on Staten Island, I should say, in New York City. And you hear him saying, "I can't breathe," and you hear his last words as he was being strangled. And I was thinking back to something that happened in our family back in 1971. We were at a family gathering for a birthday last night, and my first wife, Strongheart Stone, and we were talking about one of our closest friends back then, Henry Kellum, who was unarmed and shot and killed by the FBI on a plane in 1971 when they demanded to know why he was on the plane, and then he resisted them and he was killed unarmed. And so there's a cycle. It goes not just here. Someone else in the gathering was saying it's not just America. A young man who was just a peace-loving human being, lived in Negril, Jamaica, was gunned down by the police in Jamaica for no reason at all. It happens across the globe. And there's something about the police sitting in the state that lends itself to this. So the question is, what do we do about it? How do we begin to respond to it? Annika, why don't you start us off?
Yes, thank you. I think one of the things that I was most disturbed by with the videos is the way that the police ignored his calls for help, and which I think speaks to the devaluation of our black and brown citizens in this country when it comes to the criminal justice system, that he wasn't believed. And I was touched by, at the beginning of the video, the clip, I don't know if you played it, where he was just saying, "Please just leave me alone and I'm tired of this," which also just speaks to the relentless, I think, I would almost say attack of black and brown citizens and people who are poor by our law enforcement. So I think we need to have just a grander conversation and go beyond just the investigation of this incident, or because these incidents are not just anomalies. I mean, I think it speaks to more institutional structural racism, and to start to look at reform policies and how the police interact with these communities that of color that want and need law enforcement to come to secure these neighborhoods, but their police are not engaging them in ways that are fruitful or productive, and as we see, that can lead to the loss of life, which is criminal.
Well, let me say a couple things. First of all, you need to have the full context of this. I think I come to the same conclusions as most people being revulsed at this, but Mr. Garner was not unaggressive when the police came up to him. He said, "The way you've been treating me will stop today." And he was aggressive. But that said, anybody who has seen this, unless there is some bizarre context that is being withheld, is just appalled by it. Now, the question is, does this in fact show, as some have claimed, a few bad cops, or does it show institutional racism? And Glenn Ford, the editor of Black Agenda Report, famously already has said that it clearly shows institutional racism, but I think it shows a few bad cops. I don't think it shows institutional racism, and I think it will be forever thus. You will have incidents wherein you have hyper-aggressive cops who are not following the rules, and you're going to have these horrible, horrible situations. I don't think it's ever going to stop.
I take issue with the use of the word aggressive. I just get very concerned. I watched a video, as I'm sure a lot of people did, and if you haven't seen it, I would urge you to go onto YouTube and watch it. That's the wonderful thing about YouTube. It democratizes the news. Everybody has access to it. You can see the video for yourself. It's not like the Rodney King incident where you only see a piece of it. You can see the whole thing.
You can't see the whole thing. I disagree with that.
You can see a piece of that, and you can make a decision. But the idea that when you are approached by the cops, you cannot say anything. I did not think he was being aggressive. He said, "You are always harassing me. It is going to stop. It's going to stop today." So we can't even respond to the police when they approach us and we're not doing anything. If we respond and say anything, then we are seen as aggressive. And the next thing that happened is an escalation in violence. I mean, I think about the fact that they used a chokehold, which has been outlawed in New York for 20 years.
That's just
you can clearly see this on the video. You hear the man yelling, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe." You see more cops running up to assist the one cop who already has him in a chokehold, who already has him on the ground. You see a cop putting his knee and his head onto the guy's head and holding him down, and then you see him stop moving.
Where do we disagree?
So I'm disagreeing with the point around this idea of institutionalized racism. You're saying it's not. It's just a few bad cops. I think about that. I think about Syracuse with Alonzo Grant. That just happened. The man called the cops because his daughter was in an incident. The next thing you know, he's being slammed against the railing. He's being arrested for harassing the cops because he called about an incident. I think about New Hampshire where cops were suspended for police brutality. I don't think it's just a few bad cops sprinkled out here. There are too many incidences. I really do believe that it speaks to this idea of institutionalized.
And beyond just isolated incidents, if you just look at New York City, if you look at stop and frisk, if you look at their broken windows policy, I mean, the data shows that these policies are enforced at disproportionate numbers within black and brown communities and communities that are impoverished. I mean, that's just speaking to the data.
You bring
they're
back
not,
Bill
they're
Bratton.
They're not enforced equally across all communities, which I think does speak to some sort of institutional racism. And I don't know if I necessarily agree with that he was acting aggressive. I think that's why I was saying when he was saying, "I'm tired of this," I think it's more an indication of how much harassment that, just speaking for myself as an African-American, that black people face with the police. So it wasn't just an isolated incident for him. It's every time he's walking out. And my brothers, my uncles, my father, I mean, it's a continuous story that you hear of people saying that they've had some sort of negative interaction with the police. So you have these incidents that bubble up where you can say, oh, it's just an isolated occurrence. But I don't think that it is if you peel back the covers and look at the interactions between black and brown people and law enforcement.
I'm not going to be in the position of supporting this incident, so don't imply that I am, because I think I'm not. The question is whether isolated instance is the same thing as a few bad cops, what a few is defined as. I mean, there are bad cops. Look, when I believe it or not, back in the 1970s, when I was protesting against the Vietnam War, I was in Webster Hall Hotel in Pittsburgh, and some cops physically pushed me out of the hotel. And I had done nothing. I mean, I was kind of a protester who was kind of meek. And I immediately thought, man, these guys are out of control. And they were out of control. But on the other hand, things have changed. And you'd have to define, before you say institutionalized racism, you'd have to prove that. You'd have to define it. I'm not going to defend in the slightest what they did to Eric Garner. I think it was just outrageous. I'm just saying you've got to let everybody know what the arguments are. But I don't think the argument has been made that throughout police departments in the country we have institutionalized racism.
Well, let me throw a question out here to you all and have folks join us at 410-319-8888 to please weigh in. I think about the Tyrone Westphal was on the show as well just recently coming here often to deal with what happened to Tyrone West. 410-319-8888, your thoughts, write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And I think, you know, and we can wrestle with this idea of institutional racism, and maybe there's a broader context here as well, that it's the brutality of power.
I think that's a good point to add.
That exists, that you have this power and you do what you want with that power, and you have this blue wall of silence that surrounds you. Good cops saying we're not going to say anything because you're not supposed to say anything the same way that young people in the inner city go or any place else will go stop snitching, or people who are involved in the other ethnic American crime syndicates who was in the mafia, and they always say saying you can't snitch or you die. I mean, those things, but this blue wall of silence that surrounds the police. But also that's just, is there a way that a society can control through brutality that can be meted out by police for just any reason at all, that just forces that where the violence is overboard. I remember when Anthony Anderson was killed in Baltimore, died in the hands of the police. And I asked the commissioner, I said, when you have a policeman who has him in a bear hug and you have two other cops approaching, was it necessary to pick him up and slam him to the ground? Is that too much force?
Very clear question.
Can you just grab him? Can't the other two cops grab his hands, put him in handcuffs, and then take him away? Whether we can argue whether he should have been arrested or not is another question. But is there other? Are we not defining brutality anymore? The other kind of measures of force. I mean, that's to me is a huge part of the problem. Human forces across the globe, because they are there to ensure state power, and they do whatever they have to do, what they think they have to do.
And parenthetically, it used to be so much worse. This doesn't mean it's good now, but I'm just saying relatively, police were completely unbothered by hierarchical superiors to attenuate this kind of behavior. That doesn't mean it's good now. I'm just saying that it used to be far worse.
I think we need to put some more checks and balances in place to talk about what you just mentioned, Mark. What can we do to keep the police violence in check? I agree it used to be worse. I do not believe it has gotten any better. I think you have these incidences that bubble up, but I believe, like Annika said, beneath the surface, there are a number of incidences that are going unreported that you're not finding out about. I think it's interesting in New York City with bringing back Bill Bratton. This whole idea of stop and frisk, you know, the broken windows theory, that we have to then go after low-level criminals to stop them from doing more crime. I lived in New York when this happened, and it was everything from the squeegee men to jumping turnstiles. You were arrested, but you also saw these drops in violence, drops in homicide, which may have been related to the fact that unemployment numbers went down. You know, crack cocaine started to wane. So there are a lot of theories that could be a part of it, whether or not it's just the broken windows and stop and frisk. The bigger idea is, what can we do to protect our young men in the community, our black and brown young men? So if the police approach you, are we now saying, or have we been saying, you cannot say anything, you cannot speak up, you cannot defend yourself, because any comment from you other than complete acquiescence means that you are being aggressive, means that you are speaking back and could lead to this incident. You can't say, don't touch me. You can't say, don't abuse me. You can't say, leave me alone. You can't say anything, because any type of response could lead to what happened to Mr. Garner.
Annika, you want to jump in before we open the phones here?
I agree with what Kay has said, and I think going to your broader question, it's just a matter of thinking what type of society that we want to live in. And we incarcerate more human beings here than any other nation on the planet. So I think it does speak to a broader issue about our acceptance of violence and brutality, and the criminalization that we have, our attitudes towards criminalization in this country, I find disturbing. But I do think we need to have a conversation about that.
You know, a couple years, let me just say very quickly, a couple years ago I was in traffic court, okay? And I said that I believe that the policeman is misrepresenting what actually happened. And all quiet hell broke loose. I mean, people in power do not like to be questioned. Now, you could repeal that, but I don't know how you do it.
Well, we have to figure that out. I'm going to hear what our listeners think at 410-319-8888. And Nathaniel in Baltimore, you're the first caller up. We're going to come to your call soon as we come back from this break. And we're going to break with the 3-Minute Rule by the Beastie Boys from their album Paul's Boutique, released on this day in 1989.
Pigs, cooker, walkers, hey, bridges, grab the mic. The city shut down July 6th. The workers are raged as a general strike. Hey! The media claimed that the boys were taking over, and so it was true.
Now that's a group called Rancid, not one that I listen to every day, but they're playing a song called Harry Bridges, who was born on this day in 1901. Harry Bridges was born in Australia, was a revolutionary, came to America, and one of the leading organizers of the International Longshoremen Workers Union. So remember him. I'm not sure that Harry Richards would be listening to Rancid either, but who knows? Maybe he would. Here we go. So we're back to our conversation with our guests and some very serious subjects here with Dr. Kay Whitehead from the Loyola University here in Maryland, author of the book Notes from a Colored Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis, an amazing book. Dr. Rick Vatz from Towson University, author of the book The Only Authentic Book of Persuasion. Dr. Annika Simpson, professor in the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies here at Morgan State University, and you at 410-319-8888. Right to the phones. And Nathaniel, you're on the air.
Have me. I love your show.
Thank you, Nathaniel.
And Mr. Steiner, I mean, you're a hero, for real. But I'm chomping at the bit here with the gentleman. I don't know if you're black or white, but your incident in 71, when you were pushed, brothers and sisters were being lynched still. If you look at that video, the man wasn't being aggressive. He was pleading for you to stop. Leave me alone. It's exactly like the sister said. You can't say anything to police on the street. If you do, they take that as aggressive. Any word that comes out of a black man's mouth is being aggressive. White men do not understand this because it doesn't happen to them. They get pushed. They don't get punched in the face. Mm-hmm. This is what happens when young black man, or even, oh, I'm 48. I lived in Chicago 15 years. It's the same thing. It's not just sporadic. It's institutionalized. I mean, I believe that if you put police in the communities that they live in, it will, you know, stop that a little bit, because the police that comes, you know, into West Baltimore, he lives in Harford County. Well, maybe not the county, but he doesn't live in West Baltimore. So he doesn't care about how he treats the people or what the people think about him. That's all I have to say.
I have this great fear, as I always have, that when I leave your show, somebody's going to come up to me and say, I hear you are defending the police and how they behave against Eric Garner. It was appalling. It was appalling without qualification. I'm just saying you need to articulate all of the elements of it, and I'm also saying that when I was a kid and I was part of those who were protesting against the Vietnam War, without doing anything, I was mistreated, and people who did more were sometimes beaten and worse. I'm just saying that it used to be worse.
I just want to add, you raised a point earlier, Dr. Vatz, about this idea of institutionalized racism, of being able to get all the facts that you need to be able to make an informed decision about what it means to have a system that's based on inequality. I mean, this term that was introduced by Stokely Carmichael in the 1960s. What does it mean to have an unequal system based upon the color of your skin? There's a lot of information out there. So if people are interested in reading more about that, I would suggest they start with some of the early work, starting with the 1960s. What does it mean? Because if you read that, then you can look at what's happening in the police department, and I don't think it's too far flung to say that is a part of institutionalized racism when black and brown men are pulled over and you cannot speak back. This is anecdotal, but I want to add that we were teaching our sons about what to do when the cops pull you over. We taught them not to say anything, to be quiet, because any comment can be seen as being aggressive. I flipped that to when I speak with some of my white friends and they talk to their sons about what to do when the cops immediately tell the cops that you weren't doing anything. Tell them who you are. Tell them, I said to my boys, don't say a word, because any word might be the catalyst to something else happening.
Billy Murphy did a whole piece on this and training people how to respond when the police stop you. And it was a really interesting video I saw Billy do. I had not seen that before. I saw it a few months back. And that is real. Again, I think that we you know, part of it is also what we make illegal in this country. I mean, to have to harass a man because he sells a cigarette,
yes.
to another person. I mean, when I was growing up in my neighborhood, there were always guys selling cigarettes because someone else had the 33 cents to buy a pack of cigarettes and someone else did. So for a quarter, you could sell a cigarette and you could make a little bit of change.
How do you know this so well, Mark? I'm just kind of curious.
I grew up in it. And that's, you know, I grew up in it. I sold other things. I didn't sell cigarettes.
Not what I've heard, but go ahead.
But I think that you know, so I think that there's also this, that broken windows philosophy that also criminalizes every act.
Every act.
Every act. And I think that there's a danger in what we're created here, and we really have to. I think we can put a stop to it. We have to put a stop to it. The question of institutionalized racism is something that's much larger. That's going to take a long time to kind of weed out in our culture. But And it even make people understand, because the word people, even the word is not really readily understandable,
right.
Phrase. But let me go to before Tom and Carl and Mitchell, can I come to your calls, or Mitchell, Tom and Carl, whichever way we go to that. But let me just raise another quick issue here, separate. Then we'll go right to the phones, guys, you can talk about, and women, you can talk about whatever it is you want to talk about, guys and gals, talk about whatever you like to talk about. Let me just kind of raise this other issue, because I really think it struck me at a conversation I had last night, and conversations taking place around people's kitchen tables and barbershops and coffee shops around the city and the country, is Ray Rice. And Ray Rice being told not to play for two games, somebody is found to smoke marijuana. They're penalized for four games. A player who was found to get a free tattoo in college was suspended for five games. And people who are involved in these activities, misogyny and affecting women, it's always treated very lightly in our world of sports and in our world, period. So, yes. I mean, I'm showing my bias here. I know, I'm sorry. But, yeah. I mean, your thoughts. Annika, you want to start?
I think our sentiments are shared. My question is just, what does this say about our values as a country? I think clearly the punishment that was meted out does not equal what the incident that happened, or to show the NFL's intolerance of domestic violence policies, domestic violence incidences. My concern is what's going to happen mid-season. So if Rice has a good season and he's performing well, will this issue completely disappear? Is it going to stay at the forefront of our consciousness as it is now if he is bringing in dollars and W's, checks in the win column for the Ravens?
I tend to, with this idea that Annika and Mark are talking about, I wanted to look at it from a different perspective, because what concerns me is what Ray's now wife, how she has responded. The fact that this incident happened and she married him the next day, and now she's standing by and with him, rather than walking away from this man who seems to have a problem with anger. Any man that hits a woman, knocks her unconscious, and then drags her by her hair out of the elevator clearly has some problems with boundaries and some problems with anger and some problems with understanding what it means and how it means to treat people with respect. And she still married him. I think that there's a greater concern here. Yes, we look at Ray Rice and the fact that what he received does not fit what he actually did, this punishment that was meted out. At the same time, he seems to be winning all the way around because she married him. I'm also very concerned when I think about Stephen A. Smith's comments from ESPN. I mean, that was blowing up Twitter this weekend, if you follow this idea that even though he said on one hand, I know what to do if somebody hits, you know, my wife or my sister or my mother and all of my boys and all of my friends, we all know how to respond. Then he turned back around and said, well, let's talk about whether or not women actually provoke men to make these type of stances. What does it mean to hold a woman responsible? That's along the same line as, I raped her because her skirt was too short, or she was asking me to hit her. I think there's some bigger issues beyond Ray Rice that we need to get at around violence against women, not just in this country. But we can go to the entire planet, talking about genital mutilation with young girls. Rape is a form of terror. Like, there's a lot we can discuss
marrying
here.
Off girls when they're 11, 12,
Mark,
13
yes.
years old.
Yeah, you didn't put it together for unanimity today, did you?
We put you together for a good conversation.
Okay. Let me give some reaction to this, which will be unpopular. First of all, where I agree with you is that I think the comments by Smith were despicable, and I have nothing to say beyond what you've said about that. With respect to the Ray Rice punishment by the Ravens, the punishment should be consistent with the criminal justice system finding on him. The punishment should be consistent with the relationship to his job. When people have jobs and they do terrible things, what should their employers do? Well, it depends on how what they did relates to what they do in their job. People shouldn't necessarily lose their job because they did something terrible. So I think that the Ravens have much less responsibility here than the criminal justice system. I think you can make a much stronger argument, an argument that I would agree with, that the criminal justice system went weak on Ray Rice. To argue, therefore, the Ravens should compensate for that by giving him a 4 or 6 game suspension, I think is a non sequitur. I don't think that the Ravens have done anything wrong here. As a matter of fact, I think the National Football League has done what is probably correct. That is, they gave him a punishment consistent with the reactions of the criminal justice system, and it's consistent with his relationship, with the relationship of what he did to his job. When people use drugs, that is directly related to their work as football players. This is not.
I think I do agree that in certain, it depends on the workplace or the environment. But if you go to the NFL's personal conduct policy, they have a policy in place that speaks to this issue. So we cannot have football players going out and acting in criminal ways or engaging in domestic violence. And you had Goodell last 2 years ago trying to address and saying the domestic violence incidents amongst the players in the league. And now in 2014, when you have this happening again, and it's just a 2-game suspension, it does not seem like he's making good on his claim to weed out or stamp out this type or condoning. It seems like it's almost like you're condoning this type of behavior. Nothing's going to happen to Ray Rice. I mean, he'll miss a couple of games, and then he'll be back on the field, and it doesn't seem that the NFL is taking this seriously.
I guess my concern is not necessarily the suspension with Ray Rice, although I do agree with you. I'm concerned about what message this sends to young children who look upon Ray Rice as a hero and as a role model. I think there should be bigger standards or larger standards when you start talking about people like Ray Rice. He's not the only one, but people like Ray Rice who are in the public eye, and you have young children looking up to him. And he actually said, I know I'm a role model, and I know I'm – if you know you're a role model and you're actually saying that, then how is your behavior something that we can allow? Should we hold the standards higher for those that are in the public eye that young people are looking up to?
Well, and I think that also speaks to the point that you had raised about how his now wife would go ahead and marry him. If we're now saying that it's not that big of a deal. Or I'm looking at some stats, like 21 of 32 NFL teams had employed players with a domestic or sexual violence charge on their record last year. You've got 21 out of 32. And this incident happens, and then you just get a 2-game suspension. So and what does that say to young girls and young boys? Like, oh, you know, it's not really that big of a deal. So, yeah, let me go ahead and marry him.
Well, this notion that we should say something about people's private lives. You know, when Hillary Clinton decided to stay with Bill Clinton, I think it was an excellent decision on her part. I think
political
people,
decision,
but it may have also spoken to something between them. And I think people should not interfere either rhetorically or physically.
Well, going back to the whole question about what there's a whole deeper question of what people do when they're beaten and oppressed and how they go to their oppressor and try to make amends with them and think it's their fault and they shouldn't provoke them. But the NFL, bears a huge responsibility here to me, that as an organization, given the history of violence in sports and violence against women and the association between some athletes and violence against women, I think it behooves the NFL to take this much more seriously in terms of what should happen to Ray Rice or any player. What Annika was describing is something that is kind of should not be allowed. We there are people here like Joe Ehrman in our community of former cult, who's now a minister, who is constantly working now to expunge this innate, deep misogyny among young men around women.
Just so I'm not misunderstood, I believe the criminal justice system should have come down so much harder on Ray Rice than it did. We disagree about the NFL, but I think the criminal justice system dropped the ball on this.
And I think there's a big difference between bringing in the Hillary Clinton comment and what happened in this incident around domestic violence.
Brought up with respect to what people do in their marriage.
Right, and this idea that's one of the reasons why when women put charges against men, even if they drop the charges, the system goes ahead with the charges because somebody needs to be held accountable when these things happen.
I'm going to open the phones back. I promised I would. 410-319-8888 is the number here, and I'll say that the Reverend Kevin Slayton, who now is minister of Methodist Church in Waverly, we were together Saturday on the walk in Park Heights, and he is going to organize other ministers and people in the community to stand up to what happened here and make the Ravens wake up to what they've done, and even if it means boycotting games, he's.
I won't be joining him.
I might. 410-319-8888.
Go without me, Mark?
Let's go to Mitchell. You're on the air. Then we'll go to Tom. Mitchell, you're on the air.
Hello? I would like to go back to the topic of police brutality.
Go ahead, please. Yes.
Darryl Gates, when he was the chief of police in California, Los Angeles, he said that black people, was something genetically wrong with black people, because when they put the chokehold on them, they died.
I remember that.
So the idea of institutional racism, there have been investigations by the federal authorities of many police forces in this country that shows institutional racism. Richard Vatch, in my opinion, many times says things that have no logic to them. This is my opinion, that based on his conservative point of view, he could be dismissed if it was just his conservative point of view as far as white people and this issue. The institutional racism is so bad, and many white people say, but that was a black policeman that did that.
Tell me a little bit about your ad hominem. Tell me, specify a little bit. Excuse me. Specify a little bit your ad hominem attack. Tell me what position I've taken that you think is so outrageous.
So, you know, even when black police do that, that's part of the whole institutional racism about what black people
represent. I guess you're not going to answer my question.
Let Mitchell finish his thought, and then you can come right back. Go ahead.
So the idea that he could be – I'm making a point. The idea, from my point of view, that Richard Vatch could be dismissed because he's an apologist for the system and he's always making apologies for it, he could be easily dismissed. But it's not just Richard Vatch and his conservative point of view. This is a point of view of lots of white people who consider themselves liberals and progressives. That's the issue with how institutional racism affects almost everything we do in this country.
Let me just take one part of your absurd ad hominem attack. Who was it who 5 minutes ago blamed the criminal justice system for going easy on Ray Rice when we were talking about violence against women? It is so absurd for you to make an ad hominem attack without evidence that you really ought to be ashamed of yourself.
Well, I think maybe there's a deeper conversation to be had here. We don't have time to have today, which has to do with, I think that just like the woman who Ray Rice, his wife.
Yes, his wife, Janae.
Marrying him, and the unconscious behavior that pushes people. I think we don't always take into account the unconscious behavior that pushes in this society. And I think that most kind of what we talk about, institutional racism and racism, some people think is overt. I think it's not overt. I don't think it's covert. Mm-hmm. I think it's almost unconscious. It's part of the nature of the society that pushes and fuels things in America because of where we began, who we are, and we're still not. You can read Ta-Nehisi Coates' speaks on reparations. Should spark a conversation about whether you agree or disagree with the notion of reparations. Understand what that history means and where it's taking us.
Right.
But let me go to the phones real quick here. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Jaleel. You're on the air.
Hey there. Greetings. How are you?
Very well. Welcome.
Hey, listen, I concur with the previous caller, but the one before that, your guest mentioned about the person made the equivalent to the violence, violence in the relationship, and we can equate that with the dress being too short. I concur with what you said, but you have to put equal responsibility on parties. One obviously bears more the burden, the person who conducts in a violent act. You know, the rule has always been any action that you act or causes a bad reaction, it's obviously a bad reaction. But men and women in relationships that precede their celebrity status or their wealth, et cetera, they have responsibility equally. Even if the party is not deemed, who's not the aggressor, has to take some type of action. If you have a male or female in a relationship who is in fact physically aggressive. But I watched this behavior with them. I used to cook for the Ravens back in 2002. I used to cook breakfast and lunch with them. I know a lot of them. I've been over their homes. I watched them in their relationship. This is a cultural issue, and it goes both ways. there are two parties that are playing the game, and they're both equally responsible. You have a lot of women, men and women who are married. They're engaged in this, in what we call the flesh and the cash connection and the status connection, and it contributes to a cycle of violence. So I just want to add that in.
All right, Jaleel, thank you so much. Kay and Annika, and then we have to get back to the phones before we run out of time here and conclude our show.
Though I appreciate the caller's comments, definitely his insight in terms of working with the Ravens, there is absolutely no excuse for when a man hits a woman or a woman hits a man. There is no excuse for crossing that next level of violence. There's no way that you can hold a person responsible when they use words and you use your fist. And telling me that my words are then so controversial, they touch a chord in you, that the only response, instead of using your words, is to then hit me. And it doesn't have anything to do with just the Ray Rice situation. We're talking about domestic violence within the community. And I also do not agree it's just a cultural issue. Domestic violence is not necessarily in one culture. It permeates throughout this entire planet abusing women.
The whole planet.
So, and men abusing girls. I mean, it happens. We do have incidences, of course, of women abusing men. That does happen. But there is no excuse at all. It has nothing to do with money. It has nothing to do with the flesh and skin game that the caller talked about. There's no excuse for it. He probably needs to do a little bit more reading on domestic violence, because it has nothing to do with how much money you make, because it happens in low-income communities as well.
Well, let me just, before we go back to the phones, Annika, one of the things I was thinking as hearing all this conversation take place is that this could be a wildly controversial thing I'm about to say, but it'll be interesting to talk about one day in depth. That modern racism and the institutionalized racism that we've created in this society, I mean, the founding roots of capitalism in the West that created racism, created slavery, that built this economic system we have.
Right.
That's part of what's being debated and talked about in America today. But misogyny, I will say misogyny is something that permeates every culture and has become deeply embedded in the human condition, mm-hmm. that has to be rooted out. It's in every mm-hmm. culture on this planet. Mm-hmm. And as women become to the fore with the equal rights battles that took place across the globe, fighting for women's rights, with women getting economic power in underdeveloped countries, demanding their rights because of getting that power. There's a huge pushback by men who don't want to see women have equal power in this world. And part of the way of doing that is the violence to keep women down. So, Annika, I just wanted to throw that little commentary out. But, Annika, go ahead.
Well, thank you for that little comment. I mean, I see that. I teach women's intro to women's studies at Morgan State. I mean, it's a struggle I see amongst my students, my male and female students, as the economic structure, the power is changing. In the workplace, as you were saying, in the home. I mean, you've got the majority of head of households in the Black community are female heads of household, and how some women find that to be a problem, which I question, because you still have this idea that the man should be the head. And I think that's something that we're all wrestling with, those change dynamics. Unfortunately, though, I think that I still think globally the situation is still quite dire. Like I don't think we're at the scale that where things are tipping right now, with women being predominant in the public sector or in the corporate sector. I mean, I don't see that exactly happening at this point. Yeah,
just to reiterate, there is literally no disagreement on this panel about the abhorrence of violence against women.
As we hope there would not be. I don't think.
No, I just don't want to be misunderstood by that caller.
Well, that's a different issue.
Yeah, but I'm just saying there is no disagreement. Where there was disagreement was what the Ravens' responsibility was. That was a disagreement.
Right.
So let me go back to the phones here. Let's, Annika, you'd finish your thought before I go back to the phones?
Yes.
Okay. 410-319-8888. Let us go to, where should we go? Tom, you've been holding on for a long time. We'll try to get Tony in as well. Tom?
Hey, how you doing today, sir? I love your show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to talk about police brutality. I'm from New York, and I'm also a policeman in the state of Maryland. I want to talk about a few points real quick. Institutionalized racism. There's a lot of Black officers, especially the ones that I work with. We come from these communities, and we go out here every day. We sign a blank check to, you know, enforce law, and to up to putting our lives on the line. And that's the first point. So I don't see institutionalized racism. Second thing, the other lady said when she stopped by, or she tells her son when he stopped by the police, don't say anything. That's not what we want you to do. We want you to communicate with us. We've fought so hard to work with the community to address things like stop snitching. So the worst thing that a person can do is when an officer approaches you is to be silent. Now, the thing is that we have families just like the citizens have families, and the best thing, and I guess you'd call it the golden rule, is be respectful. We're respectful to you, you be respectful to us. That's my second point. Mm-hmm. Another one is I hear all these things when we're talking about domestic violence, and we need to hold the men accountable, and it seems like, you know, the other two ladies like almost like police bashing. But when are we going to have a conversation about holding these criminals accountable? We it seemed like that part was like completely skipped over, and the only gentleman that was really kind of or having some good sense was the gentleman that I guess everyone else that
Rick
likes
Fetz.
To bash police. They want to gang up on him, and I think he's the one with the most common sense. The thing is that you have to look at each incident, because there are black police out here, and I'm one of them, that come from these inner city communities. And we're trying to do a good job. So I don't know the part about the institutional racism. And then we, like I said, you want to hold people accountable. So when are we going to hold these criminals accountable? Every time you look on the news, you see some poor black male being gunned down by, you know, some other black male in reference to some type of drugging incident or gang incident. Why are we not having that conversation opposed to now it's like the police are making all the violence? And, you know, when you go on the news, the mayor and everyone is holding the city police and the other county police accountable for all the violence. But now we skip over the conversation of holding criminals accountable. That's my comment.
Well, Tom, don't hang up, because I tell you what, if you don't mind, don't hang up. We only have like 2 minutes left here, so make a very quick thought. I appreciate the call very much. And I'd love to be able to call you after the show just to have a conversation with you. Just about this, as we kind of really want to explore this whole idea of police and in our communities. And I'd love to hear more from you just one-on-one. And doesn't necessarily you have to come on the show as a guest unless you'd like to, but just to have a conversation with you about this.
Good man.
I'd like to have that. So
yes.
Please don't hang up, and my producer will get your telephone number, email, and I'll get back to you in the next day. I think because you know, there's a complexity to this question that I think we have to wrestle with, and Tom raised part of the complexity. And I think that people have raised on the show before that the violence that happens in the inner city, I think that most people do believe that the most violent actors in our communities have to leave us and have to go be separated from the community. They cannot be allowed right. and tolerated to threaten the lives of people in our neighborhoods. That has to end. I agree completely. But I think there are some deeper questions here that have been raised that we now do not have time to really wrestle with completely. But
I definitely want to spend some time working with it. I appreciate the caller's comments, particularly his insight as a police officer.
Right.
He had me all the way up until he said I didn't have common sense, so I disagreed with that part. that was the point where he lost me. But this idea that no one is saying that the criminals should not be held accountable, I also believe the police should be held accountable. I hope that my son approaches him so you can say something, but other cops don't believe the same thing.
He was just saying that he thought Vats had common sense. That's what he was saying.
And he's also the only one who had
very,
common
very
sense.
Quickly, if, just so you get a bird's eye view, if people could meet the Towson University police or the Towson police, you'd see an entirely different kind of individual.
Of course, there was a newspaper report this morning about Dundalk where a county policeman called up and was lecturing people on the phone because of what they said at a community meeting.
It's a big issue.
We'll come back to this. Kate Whitehead, great to have you in the studio.
Thank you so much.
From Lewis University, author of Notes from a Colored Girl, the Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Harris. Dr. Annika Simpson, always great to have you on from our university here in Philosophy and Religious Studies. And Rick Vats from Towson University, and we'll be posting, linking to his article, the editorial op-ed he wrote in The Sun. We're taking a break. When we come back from this break, we jump into Gaza and what's happening in Gaza, and then look at what's happening in Appalachia with stories that might help us all think about how we can take control of our own lives.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you all
so
much for being with us.
Thank you.
مش لابسه حرير عرس برا فرحه ביתי וכאן הרסתם את ביתי ואם זה לא חוקי מה הם שלך בן דודי אני מנסה לבנות בית ומה שנבנה לי נמצא בדור המאוש ימצא במקום שבו מלא
That is dumb. Born here. Palestinian hip-hop group that's appeared in the show before, once before anyway, and hearing their sound is appropriate for this moment. Yuhok, join us here as we look at what's going on in Israel and Gaza at this moment. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner. Sorry, I missed that last tweet last hour, but we'll try to share some of that as well. 410-319-8888. And this half hour or so, we're going to talk about what is going on in Gaza. From the voices in Gaza itself, from a reporter in Israel looking at what's going on, from somebody who's part of the protest movement, the African-American community here around Gaza, will be joining us on the show as well. And we will be bringing you a debate on Israel and Gaza in the coming days here on the program between all sides in this conflict. But each day we take a different look and a different way of looking at this. And we are joined once again by Leah Tarachinsky, who is the Israel-Palestine correspondent for the Real News Network, where the Center for Emerging Media and the Steiner Show are moving their offices sometime over the next week or two. She's a filmmaker whose current project is called On the Side of the Road. It's a very powerful film that we'll be having her on to talk about here and hope to get that to Baltimore with her. The Reverend Dr. Heber Brown joins us. He's pastor at the Pleasant Hope Baptist Church here in Baltimore, community activist who took part in demonstrations here in Baltimore. Good to have you both with us.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate the opportunity.
And we are looking forward in a moment to talk also to Mohammed Suleiman, who is a Palestinian journalist from Gaza who works with the Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights in Gaza. We are trying to connect with him right now by phone, but you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Leah, let me start with you. And again, thanks for all the reporting you're doing. The very tough situation that we've been in touch with folks in Gaza and the West Bank and Israel a lot over the last week, at least I have been, just writing back and forth. And it was interesting. One of the pieces I read this morning early was, this is a large political question before you can tell us some of the latest news, is that this has to be more, the answer to this has to be more than just a ceasefire between Israel and the Palestinians in Gaza.
Yes, right.
I'm curious as to your thoughts on that idea.
Well, I have to remind your listeners that on the second day of the war, the Hamas party has proposed to Israel a ceasefire, a permanent ceasefire based on three very simple conditions. Obviously, the end of shooting, the end of the siege on the Gaza Strip, and the third one was the release of the recently rearrested political prisoners. Those prisoners were very publicly released in the Gilad Shalit deal just a year before, and Israel took advantage of its operation in the West Bank last month and rearrested them. So those three demands were brought to the table. Israel rejected that ceasefire, followed by 6 days of Israeli leaders saying in the press and in all kinds of conferences that Israel is not interested in a ceasefire until it brings Hamas to its knees. And then 8 days into the war, they proposed the Egyptian ceasefire proposal, which basically says just an end to firing and that's it, which, of course, the Hamas party rejected because Egypt and Israel are two governments very hostile to the Hamas party, and the ceasefire proposal was brought to the Hamas leadership just hours before it was supposed to go into effect in a sort of dirty political move that Hamas basically rejected. This led to a ground invasion and all the things that happened as a result. To this day, Hamas has again and again said that they are willing to sign a ceasefire as long as it includes either easing or lifting the 7-year-long blockade on the Gaza Strip that has led to very serious water and fuel shortages. Everything, of course, made a lot worse during this war. The cutting of electricity constantly in a regular time, not in war. Most Gazans have access to only 8 hours of electricity a day. Now it's about 3 to 4 hours of electricity a day, which, as you can imagine, during a war, when you have piling numbers of wounded in hospitals and children being born, and 20% of pregnant women are giving birth prematurely, according to a story recently done by Jesse Rosenfeld, and those babies needing to be in incubators, which depend on electricity, leading to three babies dying as a result of not being able to be kept alive. There's all these complications as a result of the siege in a regular day in the Gaza Strip. Now during the war, everything's 100 times worse. So the Hamas party conditioning the ceasefire on either easing or lifting the siege is basically its statement that there's a reason why they're fighting this war. There's a reason why there are rockets being launched at Israel. On a more political level, without gaining anything politically from this war, it would be the end of the Hamas party, which was already on its last legs before the war started. So that this is a war of survival for them.
And before we come back to Leah and talk about directly what's happening there as she sees it and is reporting it, and we're still hoping that we get Mohammed Suleiman on the air with us from Gaza, who we are trying to get a hold of by phone now, but we're going to keep trying. But I know there's problems with communications in Gaza, so it may be difficult. We'll turn to the Reverend Dr. Heber Brown from Baltimore here. And Heber, it's always good to have you with us. Before we open the phones, talk to us a bit about your picture is in the paper. Standing in the demonstration to end the war in Gaza. Talk a bit about why you've become involved in this and what it's saying to you here in this community.
Yeah. Well, first, Mark, I want to thank you for the opportunity, and I'm thankful as well for Leah's reporting, and I'm thankful for Mohammed as well. I pray that we're able to connect with him because I spent the better part of an hour last night reading his articles and even his tweets. And with his unsettling honesty and attention to detail, he helped to humanize what actually was going on in Gaza for me. Oftentimes in American media, we don't hear the names of Palestinians who are killed by the Israeli military. We oftentimes don't even hear the mention of their families and their background, but Mohammed is powerful in his writing in that, and he really brought me to great pause last night. For me, Mark, I was blessed with the opportunity to be a part of a delegation to Palestine, Israel, with a group called Interfaith Peace Builders. I didn't go for tourism. I didn't go to see the quote-unquote Holy Land, as so many religious groups go to do. I went to find out for myself what was going on the ground because I had a sneaky suspicion that what was coming across the TV, in particular in America, was not the whole story. And I was exactly right. I was blessed with the opportunity to meet with Palestinians and Israelis to hear directly from them what the root causes of this situation is all about. A lot of people like to talk about rockets, but I like to focus on roots. And at the root, it is, as Leah said a few moments ago, the siege and the occupation of Palestinians. The roots go back to the displacement of people from their land. And so, that was compelling enough for me to get involved. And then, Mark, when I saw the connections between the plight of Palestinians and the condition of black people here in the United States, I saw the relationship between the oppression of African Americans and the occupation of Palestinians, the tools, the methods, and even the spirit behind the merciless massacre of Palestinians is comparable, in my view, to the same vicious terrorism that black people face here in the United States. And one final point, I know you've got to move on, but one final point as well. As a Christian pastor, the Palestinian Christian community, with their Kairos document in 2009, asked us to do some specific things for the church community. And your listeners, I know many of them are church attenders and the like, but the Palestinian Christian community asked sister churches around the world not to offer a theological cover-up for the injustice that they suffer, the sin of occupation. And they asked to, you know, churches to get involved with boycott and divestment. And I'm so glad that so many denominations here in the U.S. have made great progress on that front.
Folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. And we're going to hear more directly about what's going on at this moment from Leah Tarachansky. Hopefully, Mohammed Suleiman, if we can get through to him in Gaza. My producers are trying now to get through to Gaza. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Let's get a couple of calls in here, then we'll come right back to Leah. And let's go to Michael first in Pikesville.
Being omitted here is it's not just a question of Israelis' merciless persecution of the Gazans. Because first of all, that's a misnomer because anyone can see that they give them due warning to get out of there, and they keep their children in there with them with the missiles. They protect their missiles with their own children, making them human shields. But what I want to say is that if you look at Hamas's charter, you see that it's much more than the so-called occupation. Also a misnomer, Hamas's charter says they want to kill Jews everywhere, not just there. They have this merciless motive they make into a sacrament to slaughter the Jews. And this Uncle Jake, Mark Steiner, who cozies up to the enemy when he purports to be a Jew,
thanks for the attack. I appreciate it. But, you know, we always get attacked when we stand up for human rights. That's nothing new, nothing I'm not used to. But Leah Terechets, Leah, let me kind of deal with some of the points that that were raised by Michael here, because you hear often. Let's talk about the three things he said: the Hamas people as human shields, the question of the Hamas charter, and the question of the warning. Let's start with the warning.
Yeah. So first of all, I think that people really need to read the charter, and they really need to read it in Arabic before they're commenting on it. The point that is always brought forward by the Hamas charter is that they claim that all of the state of Israel, all the territory of the state of Israel, and all of the occupied territories is Palestine, and they claim that they want autonomy over all of Palestine, and that is often being interpreted as they don't want Israelis or Jews on that land, which is not true. In our interview with the Hamas leaders in 2010, they were very clear about what they actually want. And I want to bring to your attention that the charter of the Likud party, which is the party of the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, also says that all of the territory on which Israel currently exists, including the Palestinian occupied territories, half of Jordan and half of Lebanon, is historical Israel that belongs to the Jewish people. So there's a lot of inciting language in all kinds of political documents on every side of this. And as far as the human shields thing is concerned, you know, the BBC journalist Jim Bauer the other day wrote a very important piece. He's been reporting out of Gaza since 1990, and he has been in and out of the Gaza Strip for 30 years. And he wrote, "I did not see any evidence of the Hamas fighters using people as human shields." You have to remember that the Gaza Strip is home to almost 2 million people. Those 2 million people are locked inside of a strip that's 45 kilometers long. In a strip that small, with so many people, if you're going to be hiding roughly 9,000 rockets, which is what the Israeli estimate is of the Hamas arsenal, you inevitably are going to be no more than within a few meters of civilians. Now, Israel, the last 21 days, has killed 1,035 people. Of them, according to Physicians for Human Rights, 82% are civilians. Now, the Israeli government is constantly arguing that we are currently in the midst of a surgical operation, et cetera, et cetera. In the Israeli press, you're hearing constantly that if anyone who is killed is not a combatant, then, you know, it's an anomaly or it's the fault of the Hamas party. But if we cannot wage a war in a way where 82% of the killed are not civilians, we don't have a right to wage a war. In the beginning of the 20th century, the vast majority of casualties of war were combatants. On the Israeli side, 46 people have died in this war. Out of the 46, 93%, 43 people are combatants, soldiers in combat. When you're waging a war, soldiers get killed. But if you're waging a war where 82% of the casualties are civilians, and then the leaders of our country, the leaders of Israel, are going on every major news source saying that the casualties are the fault of the party that they come from, it's a kind of ridiculous logical argument that is very disappointing to hear people abroad repeat verbatim without actually thinking about. How can you blame the civilians that have been sitting under siege for 7 years? Most of them are not allowed to leave the Gaza Strip, both by the Egyptian and Israeli government, of supporting a party that is fighting Israel, when they see that party as the only group trying to defend them from continuous ongoing Israeli bombardments. This war that just started 21 days ago is not the first time Israel bombed Gaza. As a journalist living here and as an Israeli, I can tell you, Israel bombs Gaza more or less every week. people are constantly being killed there, and it's just not on the news anymore. Now that it has led to a full-blown war and Hamas is responding with rockets and the whole shebang, you have, you know, reporters like me and you writing about it every day, and you have world attention being paid to it and finally being paid to the siege. But on the regular day, Israel bombs Gaza anyway, and no one even talks about that. So yes, when some party comes around, even though I don't agree with Hamas, I don't agree with their charter, and I think that their internal political positions are very detrimental to the people of Gaza, let alone their foreign policy. Still, they are perceived by the Palestinians as at least someone trying to defend them against ongoing and relentless bombardment.
And let me just say that the two things before we go back to the phones, I'm going to return to the Reverend Dr. Heber Brown, is we've been in touch with Mohammed Suleiman from Gaza. Something's happening there right now. He will be joining us in about 10 minutes or less for this conversation, and we'll find out what's happening after he joins us. And let me just say before we go to our next caller and bring in the Reverend Dr. Heber Brown back in the conversation, because I think it's only fair to our listeners who may not know the language that was just being used earlier with the previous caller. When he called me an Uncle Jake, that was like calling somebody an Uncle Tom. And but what it really means is that for somebody like me, and I'll just put it out there for all our listeners, and you can bring your comments, agree or disagree, at 410-319-8888. As someone who grew up in a home in a family of Holocaust victims and grew up in a home of people who were tortured and killed during the pogroms, as someone who grew up in a home that was a Zionist home that believed that Zionism was a theology, it was a notion of liberation from the oppression that Jews felt. And then you had your eyes opened, partially because of your civil rights work, partially of your work in living in the black community, and then coming into seeing what happened after the war in 67 when I volunteered to join the Israeli army to fight. Then you see for yourself what happens when you meet Palestinians and you meet Arab Americans and you see what's really going on. You realize what we have become. You can't let that happen. You have to speak up. So if that makes me an Uncle Jake, then I'll be Jake Steiner. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Ricardo. You're on the air.
You touched on one thing that I did want to say as far as the Israelis being the people that were supposed to have been persecuted by Hitler. And you would think that these people would have a clear understanding or know, you know, to treat people in that manner. I mean, sometimes I kind of wonder, you know, after going through what the Jewish people supposedly went through, and then, you know, to see the condition of the Palestinian people being put in that little space of land, and then you hear them say stuff like, well, we drop leaflets down and tell them to get out of there. Where are they going to go, man? Where are they going to go? They have nowhere to go. And, you know, it's amazing the propaganda that they use to, you know, to do these things, and it's a sad case. And if they are really the Jewish people, the people of God, then that particular God, I truly would want to serve. Because it's just a sad, sad day when you see children and women and people dying like this. And, you know, and they talk about the rockets that's coming from Hamas. Hamas was a creation of them. Like we created Al-Qaeda. They created them.
Okay. Ricardo, we now have Mohammed Suleiman, who's joined us from Gaza. We're going to go to him and then go to Reverend Heber Brown. But let me just say quickly, Mohammed, welcome to the show. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
And I think that, you know, Heber, before we turn to Mohammed, one of the things that it struck me that it doesn't take much in the annals of human history for the oppressed to become an oppressor. That switches in human history. It doesn't mean that we put up with it or accept it, but I think that's not an uncommon thing.
It's definitely not. I mean, we've seen it a number of ways, and particularly in this particular instance, you know, when I think about the last caller, and I think about your comments too, Mark, and I really appreciate you sharing more of your story, because in my experience since I got active on this issue, I've seen many Jewish Americans and many Israelis speak up and say, this cannot be done in our name. This is not Judaism. This is not the essence of what we believe. And I appreciate and I understand the courageous voices in the Jewish community who are speaking up, from the head of Jewish Voices for Peace, who was arrested last week in New York, I believe, to even local Jews in Baltimore area who are speaking up as well. I appreciate that. And this Wednesday at Penn Station at 5:30, there's another rally, Baltimore for Gaza, and really people calling for justice. Penn Station this Wednesday at 5:30 to be a part of that.
So let me, Mohammed Salamina, glad you could join us. Thank you so much for being with us here, who is a human rights worker in Gaza. So can you give us the latest of what's been going on even today that we don't know about?
Yeah, I mean, recently we've been hearing a lot of, news about an impending ceasefire. But just now there was an airstrike that targeted Gaza's main hospital, Al-Shifa Hospital. And I'm not sure if there has been any deaths or injuries. But this is to say that although Israel claims that it has agreed to extend the ceasefire, it has actually violated it just now and bombed Gaza's main hospital. So what I'm trying to say is that the bombing hasn't stopped, the shelling hasn't stopped. Israeli unmanned drones, warships, and artillery continue to fire shells and bombard the Gaza Strip. The death toll is, dramatically rising. We're now talking about over 1,000 deaths, and the majority of whom are civilians. The situation in Gaza is pretty scary. No one would love to be in Gaza at the moment. It's really dangerous to go outside now. You could be a target for an Israeli missile. We believe that anyone in Gaza is a target for the Israeli war machine. So, it's just so beyond comprehension what is happening in Gaza. You know, we see little children torn to pieces, disemboweled. So, you know, the agony and the pain of the Palestinians has become just so massive and beyond comprehension, really.
And I think that it's important to hear your voice in this, Mohammed, because I think that when we produced our series on the war in Vietnam years back, we had soldiers talking about, especially one talking about what it was like to be in the midst of war, because unless you're in it, you don't understand what it's like. And you're talking about what's happening on the ground now is critical for people to hear to understand what the panic and pain and fear is like among regular citizens of Palestinians, just regular everyday human beings trying to live their lives. And have nowhere to go. You have nowhere to go.
I have nowhere to go, yeah. I'm just staying at home at the moment. I'm thinking of doing some basic stuff, and which I can't really do. For example, just 1 week ago, there was a strike which hit just so close to my home. And I had to leave my house because of the strike. A few windows were blown out. I went to the north of Gaza where my family lives. I spent a few days there. And then in the north of Gaza, there was also intense bombing, and Israeli forces warned residents of the north of Gaza to leave their homes because, you know, they said that they're going to intensify their attacks and extend the military operation. So my family and I moved again to Gaza City, where my brother lives. So we're trapped. Basically, we're trapped. We have nowhere to go. Israel warns us to leave our houses, but it doesn't give us an option to a safe haven to go to. And we have seen families, like thousands of families, who decided to go to UN schools and seek shelter there. But even there, one of the schools in Beit Hanun, which was turned into a makeshift shelter, was bombed and 16 civilians were killed. So even in UN schools, civilians could be a target. Basically, we're trapped in Gaza. We're trapped between two deaths, death by Israeli bombs and missiles and death by the Israeli blockade. So this is just sort of trying to bomb the Palestinians in Gaza into submission. And I have no words to describe the situation for anyone. Like, you know, one has to be really in Gaza to understand what it means to be living in Gaza under Israeli bombs.
going to take a very brief break, and I'm asking my guests to stay with us just a little bit longer. And we have with us Mohammed Sulaimin, who is a human rights worker from Gaza, Leah Tarachansky, Israel-Palestine correspondent for the Real News Network. Her documentary film is called On the Side of the Road, which we'll be talking about more in the coming months. The Reverend Dr. Heber Brown, pastor at the Pleasant Hope Baptist Church here in Baltimore, and community activist. 410-319-8888. We'll come right back to Leah Tarachansky and Rhonda and Ernest, who are callers on the phone, before we start our next segment on Appalachia. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. We are looking at the latest that's happening in Gaza and the war between in Gaza, in the Israeli war in Gaza right now. We are here with Leah Tarachansky, who is Israel Palestine correspondent for the Real News Network, Mohammed Sulaimin, a human rights worker in Gaza, the Reverend Dr. Heber Brown, pastor of Pleasant Hope Baptist Church, and you at 410-319-8888. We'll get to these calls coming in, and we do want to hear them all. Somebody who's upset about the way this conversation is going, we'll hear what they have to say. But Leah, let me talk about what's going on from inside Israel and politically reporting on where is the conversation shifting at all in Israel about the war and how it's being conducted and whether it should end.
Yeah, so usually in previous wars, our experience was that when Israeli soldiers start dying and the public opinion shifts against the war, the more soldiers die, the more intensely pressure rises against the leadership to pull out of the war and to end it quickly. And I have to explain to your listeners that the Israeli army is perceived in Israel as the strongest national symbol, as the biggest uniting point of Israeli society. Our soldiers are perceived both as our boys, because everybody in Israel, men and women, everybody has to serve. All the Jewish citizens have to serve. And also it's seen as Israel's survival, in the Middle East. And so the army, being against the war means being against the army. That's how it's perceived in Israel. And being against the war, being against the army, is perceived as treason. Now, here in this war, what we've seen is we've lost more soldiers than we have in every war in the last decade. And yet, with every passing day, support for the war increases. And instead of asking for a ceasefire, most people are asking for a stronger attack on Gaza and a bigger hit to the Hamas party. Now, on the streets, we've also seen a growing anti-war movement. It started out with just a few dozens on the streets in Yaffa. It grew to a few hundreds in Tel Aviv, and on Saturday night there was a protest with almost 7,000 people. And every time that there's an anti-war demonstration, there is also a big demonstration of pro-war and neo-fascist groups standing against it. And those groups, while the anti-war demonstration chants things like, in Gaza and in Sderot, children just want to live, and the war, lift the siege, things like that, the pro-war and the neo-fascist groups chant death to all the Arabs. Tomorrow there's no school in Gaza because all their children are dead. And anyone who opposes the war is a traitor, kill all the traitors, kill all the leftists, and so on. Very inciting, very violent messages. Now, in the first few weeks, it was just chanting. Now we're seeing that there's a huge mobilization online of extreme right-wing nationalists who are trying to identify on social media anybody who opposes the war. They attack them. They call their employers to get them fired. There's been a number of people that were fired as a result of posting things against the war or pro-Palestinian things online. And they are now also being very violent towards leftists, trying to beat them. At every demonstration on Saturday night, after people left the anti-war demonstration and went home, mobs of raging neo-fascists followed them to their houses and beat them. One guy, a bystander, came up to him and hit him with his crutch and cracked his skull. I witnessed a soldier in uniform coming up to a group of anti-war demonstrators and pepper spraying them. When the police saw him, they gave him a high five and let him go. So we're seeing here a total unity in the Israeli population with the war, and anyone who opposes it, which, you know, even if you get thousands of people on the streets, is still a very marginal proportion of the society. Anyone who opposes the war is now afraid of posting on social media, afraid of expressing their opinions at war, afraid of being caught on the street with people who come from this camp and can easily beat them, and the police is doing nothing.
Let me go to the phones here, and then we only have like 5 or 6 minutes left in this segment, and I do want to get our guests back on, both hear more from Mohammed Suleiman and the Reverend Heber Brown as well. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Judy first. Judy, you're on the air.
Thank you so much. Thank you for giving airtime to this important topic. 2 points. One question to you, Mr. Steiner. It seems to me that all of your panelists are very, very clearly taking the position of the Gaza, you know, the individuals in Gaza, and only that perspective. How come I don't hear anybody on the panel that's representing the Israeli Defense Forces?
Well, actually, I've been away, and it was my decision to do that when I was asked by my producers what to do. So we want you to hear voices from Gaza that you don't hear on very many media in this country at all. Over the last 21 years of this program, we've always had we've always been covering Israel and Palestine in a very intense way and a very balanced way for the whole time of this program, and we'll continue that. We plan to have that debate coming on the air again this week and hear more voices from Israel as well during the course of the week. On our website, you'll also hear this Voices of the Holy Land series that we produced over a 3-year period where every side, from the extreme right to the extreme left, Palestinians and Israelis, all were heard on this program. But we wanted to hear Gazan voices today, because you don't hear Gazan voices. That is what I did, and that's what we're doing today. And what's your second point?
Yes, well, just in follow-up to that point, it would seem to me that for the sake of fair journalism, that at least it should be noted that this program today is only representing or primarily representing the one viewpoint, you know, and that perhaps you will be getting a sort of second segment at a later point. My second point is that just a brief moment, I do have close relatives that are in the Israeli army that are very involved in the Israeli scene there. If you read any of the Israeli news sources, such as the Arutz Sheva website, it is absolutely astounding the amount of warnings that Israel has been giving the Palestinian people. Helicopters flying, putting leaflets down saying, people, evacuate this area. 24 hours from now, it's going to be bombed. Another warning. In addition to that, before a house would, if there was considered to be a suspect terrorist in a particular home, Israel will come and have some sort of device connected, I believe, to an airplane that sort of knocks on the roof of the house to give an additional warning. We mean it. Move away. Don't be in harm's way. And the
Well, let me let her finish, and then you can come right back in. Mohammed, you can come right back in. Go ahead. Finish what you're saying, Judy, then we'll go back to our guest. Judy, you still there?
Yes, I am. Thank you. In addition to that, if one inquires into it, why are there reports of hospitals and schools being bombed? Because the Hamas government or organization is using these facilities as human shields and is, in fact, from what I understand, telling its inhabitants, don't listen to the Israelis. When they tell you to get out of the area, stay there, be a martyr. And in addition, and my final point is that, again, and I request anybody to find evidence to the contrary, Israel has set up tents with doctors treating Palestinian people that are still not listening to these warnings and are casualties. Israel will be there treating these victims as it continues to treat other Palestinian and Arab citizens in its hospitals. Thank you.
Judy, thank you. I wanted to let you have your thought out. Mohammed, I heard you trying to break in. Please come in and say what you're about to say, because we do have to take a break very shortly. Mohammed?
Yes.
Did you want to respond to what you heard?
Yeah, of course. First, I would like to say that the Israeli claims that they are warning Palestinian civilians to, stay away from Hamas militants are just completely ridiculous. Because basically, when Israeli warplanes dropped leaflets on the north of Gaza district as well as the east of Gaza district, they have warned nearly 500,000 people to leave their houses, because 250,000 people live in the north of Gaza. 250,000 people live in east of Gaza. So Israel is basically asking 500,000 people to leave their houses. This is in a place that is populated by nearly 2 million people. So Israel is warning civilians. This is true, but this is completely impractical and unrealistic. Israel is doing this in order to deceive the world that it is actually trying to avoid civilian deaths. So this is number one. Number two, when Israel says that Palestinian civilians have to stay away from Hamas militants, at the same time it is not giving them a safe shelter. So I'll give you one example. There was a family, Al-Kailani family, which lives in the north of Gaza district. So after they heard Israeli warnings to evacuate to the center of Gaza City, they heeded Israeli warnings. They went to Gaza City. They hired a flat in Gaza City. They stayed in that flat. And what happened is Israel killed them there. Israeli warplanes targeted the building that they were living in Gaza City, and they were killed in Gaza City, which Israel told them to go to. So basically, there is no safe place in Gaza. All Israeli claims that, we are warning civilians are unfounded. They are ridiculous. When Israel, for example, fires what it calls warning missiles on buildings, these warning missiles are lethal. They are deadly. They have killed too many people. We know the story of three children from Shaheber family who were feeding their chickens and pigeons on the roof when Israel fired a missile on the building. So it killed all three children who were on their building. So we know the story of the four children from Bakr family who were playing on the beach when Israeli warships fired a missile and killed two of them. Then they ran away for their lives. Israel shot another missile and killed them. So what we see from numbers, from facts on the ground, is that Israel is deliberately targeting civilians. If not deliberately, then it is using disproportionate force and indiscriminate attacks against the Palestinians. In Ash-Shija'iyya, where in one night, more than 100 people were killed, Israeli artillery indiscriminately shelled and fired its shells toward the entire area. It displaced nearly 100,000 people. For example, in UN schools, which are now makeshift shelters for families, there was an attack at the school which killed 16 civilians. Four or five of them are children. So how can we talk about Israel warning Palestinian civilians to stay away from Hamas militants, while at the same time it is actually going for them? It is actually targeting them. So from facts, from numbers, we can just clearly debunk these Israeli claims which have nothing to do with reality.
Mohammed, thank you so much.
I just want to add something to Leah,
We only have like 10 seconds literally because we have to move on to our next segment. But go ahead, Leah, you can close us out.
Sorry, I really resent your listener's comment that because I oppose an unjust, brutal war, I am somehow anti-Israeli. I'm an Israeli. I live here. I get rocketed as the same as your relatives. And I'm sorry, but supporting a blind war that our three hospitals are destroyed, 12 clinics are targeted, more than 1,000 people are
dead. How many Israeli civilians were killed? This is the question. How many Israeli civilians were killed? These two civilians who were killed are regrettable. I'm sorry for their death. We're talking about over 1,000 Palestinian civilians. How can you compare between Israeli violence and Palestinian violence? There is no way to compare between the oppressive violence and the oppressed violence. Israel is obviously accountable for what is happening.
Exactly. And supporting this war is not being pro-Israeli. America allowing this war to go on and more than 1,000 people getting killed is not being pro the citizens of Israel.
So I'm sorry we do have to take a break here. This has been a very intense and interesting and important conversation. Reverend Dr. Heber Brown, I'm sorry we couldn't get back to you just last moment. Thank you so much for being here. And we'll see you all on Wednesday at the demonstration at the – where was that again?
Penn Station this Wednesday at 5:30.
Mohammed Suleiman, stay safe. Human rights worker from Gaza, thanks so much for joining us. You and your family, be safe. Leah Terechansky, Israel-Palestine correspondent for Real News Network. Thank you once again for helping us with this program.
Thanks for having me.
Good to talk to you all, and we're going to take a brief break, and we turn our attentions to a part of America that is changing itself. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Johann Sebastian Bach. Today is his birthday. The band did have rhythm. We are here with Laura Flanders. She's an author, journalist, and broadcaster, has been on the cutting edge of new economy coverage. She was one of the first to cover the remarkable story of Chicago window factory workers who went from being laid off en masse to occupying their factory, eventually buying it as a worker-owned co-op. She is an online channel, Grit TV, is still with us and doing in-depth work. She's also now working as the local strong local economics writer for Yes Magazine, where she wrote this article, Breaking the Grip of the Fossil Fuel Economy. If it can happen in Appalachia, it can happen anywhere. And Laura, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Oh, good to be with you, Mark. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you doing? It's been a while.
I'm doing very well. This story was really very inspiring, and I'm very excited to talk about it.
I want to hear you talk about it because that's one of the things between your books and your articles, you do that. You always bring us stories of people who are actually making the change.
Well, I think that's where the news is. You know, the last people to make it to the front page of the New York Times are often the first people on the cutting edge of change. And thank heavens for independent media like yours and Yes Magazine and Grit TV. It's not a matter of doing anybody any favors to cover these stories. It's what makes us smarter to see what's coming down the pike for the rest of us. And that's certainly what I saw in Appalachia.
I love this one line in here that actually was part of, I think, a subtext of the theme and of what you wrote, which was a quote from Michael Harrington. Was rather than another America, or about Michael Harrington's book, Another America, rather than another America, Appalachia has always offered a reflection of what's coming up down the road for the rest of the country.
That's right. I mean, I spoke to the most extraordinary people for this story, many of whom made it into the piece, and many more know that they had input. Among others, the extraordinary Helen Lewis, who's been studying Appalachia and Appalachia culture for many, many years, lived there since the mid-50s, and she really put it in perspective. You know, when people cover Appalachia 50 years ago, when they were covering the war on poverty's beginnings, or even today as they've covered the anniversary of the war on poverty, they tend to talk about a backward culture, a culture of poverty, people left behind. And Michael Harrington, for all his good work, also reflected on that part of the country as another America, a place left behind. And what I learned so clearly from the people that I spoke to there, Helen Lewis and Ronald Eller, the author of Uneven Ground, An Amazing History of the Region, was, no, flip this picture on its head. In the same way that Appalachia was the front line of our transformation to the industrial fossil fuel economy, so, too, it was on the front line of feeling the devastating effects of that kind of mass industrial fossil fuel extraction, extreme extraction, if you will. the front lines of experiencing what happens when we turn our democratic systems of government over to corporations. And they're on the front lines now of trying to figure out change. How do we unravel this situation? It's going to take a lot. It's going to take land reform. It's going to take a reinvestment in local democracy. It's going to take capacity building among these extraordinary, creative, ingenious folks who are survivors through and through, who live locally, and they're the ones who know what's best for their local region. But it's also going to take the rest of us culturally realizing, dang, you know, as Helen puts it, you know, the questions here in Appalachia are the questions everywhere. She says, who owns this place? Where do the profits go? What can people do? Who has control? And if those aren't all of our questions, I don't know what are.
She sounds like a phenomenal human being, just as she does. And I think that what I want to talk a bit about with you is, you know, when you look at the power that coal has in Appalachia, that coal is a dying industry, but it wasn't just that. It was what you were describing here, that there's this strange thing that happens in human consciousness because of our own survival. And you, so you have coal here who supplied, because of unions, a lot of high-paying jobs for a long time. Those are drying up, but the profits always left Appalachia and never stayed there. And the poverty became intense. But people still are kind of in some ways addicted to the past and the myth of what coal did.
Well, it's not the people being addicted to the past so much as the property ownership has remained in the same old hands.
Uh-huh.
So the same corporations that at one point were mass-producing coal for production all around the country and the world are now holding onto that land, some of them transitioning to so-called natural gas. Others of them, who knows what they're waiting for, but they still control three-quarters of the state, the landmass. So we don't know what the people are addicted to, but we know the economic and the democratic system is addicted to big power and the big financial donations that come from big corporations and big landowners. They wield enormous influence over the regulatory system in the community. And frankly, they still hold back innovation. I interviewed a guy who runs a winery on a former mined property, and he would love to expand. His winery is very successful. But he can't expand because all the land around him is owned by a coal company, and they won't sell it, or at least they won't even lease it for more than a year, which isn't going to do him any good. So, you know, again, these questions of ownership, sure, extreme extraction, fossil fuel production has been the perhaps most harmful expression of the concentration of power under industrial capitalism. It is certainly not the only expression of the abuse of that kind of power. And I hope that people will see in this story parallels to the economic challenges that face all of us as we try to figure out how do we actually create a democracy that has as its number one priority serving the interests and the well-being of we the people, not just the profit owners. So I think, you know, I really think that's the question
right.
of the story. It's the question of the region, and it's fascinating, fascinating stuff.
So I think it's important here in the time we have together this morning, Laura, to kind of explore two things. One is you spent some time in the article talking about Apple Shop, and who those folks have appeared in the show before in years past, about what they're doing to creatively kind of change the world they're in. And let's just start there.
Sure. Well, Apple Shop was founded by actually a War on Poverty-funded project in the late 1960s and became an organization that is, you go down into their vault downstairs. They've just started a beautiful new climate-controlled vault that is now available to people across the country, certainly across the region. You go down and you just see piles and piles of videos and DVDs and tape and audio. They have a radio station on the ground floor that you and I would love to go out onto the street. And it's, you know, this is, they've been telling the stories of the people living in Appalachia, their culture, their the fun they have, as well as the crises they face. And they've been reporting on the coal disasters and the mining problems and the problems with chemicals long before they hit the national news. They've also been covering the mobilization. I mean, the other side of the story here is, you know, out of Appalachia has also come some of our most effective organizing, whether you're talking United Mine Workers Union that brought us the labor movement in lots of ways, one of the first strong unions in the country, ended child labor. You think of Mother Jones bringing folks from Appalachia to Philly, to New York, to stand on the lawns of the coal owners. That was creative practice that worked.
Today you see a similar kind of invention on the part of local environmental groups. You know, on national green groups, and we're grappling with this around this fall mobilization in New York at the UN, our national green groups tend to vilify the users of the coal or the users of the plastic. Coal is bad. You know, we always had coal. People had coal, small coal mines in their backyards in the mountains for years. The problem is with the corporations. And what I was so struck by and really deserves a whole nother story is how the locally based environmental justice groups, along with the citizens' legal organizations, have their sights set firmly on corporate justice, on getting reparations from corporations for the ill health of the miners, of the people who live in the mining devastated communities, and not just from the corporations, but from the country as a whole. So they're very focused on how can we get justice in a concrete way, how can we get corporate accountability, and stop the vilification of the people that dig the coal and use the coal. We're kind of the end of a very long chain of problems, and the power problems are the ones that should be higher up our list of priorities.
And in the couple minutes we have left here, and I do apologize, our Gaza segment went over, but what I'd like to do in the future with this article you've written is do a much longer feature with you on the program and some of the people involved, when we can really produce that together, because I think that it's an inspiration for the entire nation to hear people.
I would love that, and if we don't think that Gaza is about resources too, we're missing an important link. So I value did the Gaza coverage, and I'm totally with you to do another story on Appalachia. Figure out the connection.
No, and we'll make the connection just about Appalachia and our urban areas here, and what these connections are. And I think that's an important piece to make happen. And again, I apologize for having to make this a shortened segment. We're going to do a much longer one with you in the coming weeks, and we'll figure out how to do that. And we will do it. And Laura Flanders, I think, is one of our most important journalists, and she's now doing incredible work with the Yes Magazine as writing about strong local economies. And we're going to link to this article. We want you to read it, and because we're going to come back with Laura in the coming weeks and others to talk about what this really means for all of us in terms of what we can do to reclaim and retake and rebuild our communities. Laura Flanders, thank you so much for all you've done from Greek TV to Yes and everything else.
Thanks so much. Keep up the great work, Mark.
Thank you. So that is our program for today. I want to thank you all for being part of it. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's not just a bank. It's a credit union. It belongs to you. For more information, www.mecu.com. We are going to be talking later in this week about this event, but the Protect Yourself annual fundraising event is happening again this Saturday, August 2nd, 2014, from noon to 7 p.m. It's an incredibly important project, working with young people on HIV and STIs. All kinds of art and media and skills will be taking place at Sunshine Acres at 29938 Kids Schoolhouse Road in Parkton, Maryland. And more information can be found at 443-670-7467. And we'll be talking about that a great deal more in the coming week. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Henry. Our engineers are Andrea Melton. Our interns are Alex Boston, Matt Malice, Maggie Dyer, Sienna Greaves, and Sam Saper, both of whom are with us today. And to hear the show again, podcast any of our past shows, please go to our website, steinershow.org, or download our work now on iTunes, the podcast you want to hear and listen to. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, celebrating the 88 days of summer. Before I tell you who I am, that is, what are you listening to right now? You're listening to Leader of the Pack by the Shangri-Las, because the poor woman who was great in the Shangri-Las, Marge Gonier, passed away from breast cancer on this day. Remember her and her great work. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.